It's Wednesday, January 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, President Obama's deportation protection plan to go before the Supreme Court. The immigration debate reminds many Americans of past issues we hear from a Japanese American held in a U.S. detention camp during World War II.
At this stage, the UN will proceed with issuing invitations when the countries spearheading the International Syria Support Group process come to an understanding on who among the opposition should be invited.
The difficulties in discussing Syria's future, and we've lost yet another rock legend. It's all in today's International Edition. The U.S. Supreme Court said Tuesday it will consider a case challenging President Barack Obama's plan to protect 4 million undocumented immigrants from deportation. The president's 2014 executive order is aimed at deferring the deportation of undocumented parents of American-born children and permanent residents. But the Obama order is on hold due to opposition from 26 U.S. states, almost all of them led by Republican governors who often criticize policies supported by the Democratic president. Earlier, my colleague Susan Yonke asked VOA reporter Carolyn Pursuti about the significance of the Supreme Court stepping into the controversy.
Well, basically, the Supreme Court has decided to hear a challenge to President Obama's executive order to shield more than 4 million immigrants from deportation. Now, these would be immigrants who have U.S.-born children, which make the children American citizens.
What is the president's argument for doing this?
The president's argument is that these are not criminals. These are not the administration's priority for deportation. These are people who could be paying taxes. As long as they have a work permit, as long as they are working, then they can contribute to the nation's economy.
And those who are opposed to it?
Those who are opposed to it say, we are just encouraging other people to enter the United States illegally and continue to stay here, and then we are rewarding them. So that's basically the argument of the Federation for Immigration Reform, the organization known as FAIR.
Nothing happens quickly at the Supreme Court. This could drag on for quite a while.
Absolutely. We aren't expecting the arguments to be heard before the Supreme Court until April, and then a decision won't be made until June.
But this will be a case that's closely watched by many people.
Absolutely, because this will not only affect the 2016 presidential election, but also the president's legacy. He stepped out on a limb, if you will, by making these executive orders, these executive actions, and certainly this was one of the more far-reaching executive orders that he has done. And the fact that the Supreme Court will be making a decision in June clears the way for a decision to be made while the president is in office. Should they rule in favor of the president's deferral program, then these immigrants can stay in this country. Should they rule against it, immediately they would be sent back to their country.
VOA's Carolyn Pursuti. Well, time now for our social media segment, International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me to tell us what's buzzing online about the upcoming SCOTUS decision. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. The Supreme Court announced it will decide the fate of President Obama's immigration actions this term. House Speaker Paul Ryan, a Republican, was quick to criticize Mr. Obama. He's on Twitter at Speaker Ryan and sent out this tweet. President Obama's executive amnesty is unconstitutional. I hope hashtag SCOTUS upholds the Fifth Circuit's decision. Retweet to agree. That's the acronym for the Supreme Court of the United States, and more than 200 people share that tweet Tuesday.
Okay, so not a crazy amount of attention, but definitely in line with his party beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
What about another view?
There isn't really much info about it yet, and I think more people will voice their opinions once the court's decision is out. In the meantime, Virginia Senator Mark Warner shared his thoughts. He tweeted, I am confident hashtag SCOTUS will support the president's decision to use his legal authority to set enforcement priorities. His handle is at Mark Warner. Jim, I also want to recommend to our listeners to check out the Pew Research Center's tweet. Its handle is at Pew Research, and it shared an infographic. Now, I don't want to give everything away, but the infographic shows who would benefit from the executive actions. One takeaway is that out of the 11.2 million unauthorized immigrants in the United States, almost 6 million people are not eligible. That's almost half of the undocumented immigrants. Last but definitely not least, I want to give a shout out to our own Cindy Sain, who sent out this tweet. She wrote, hashtag VOA alert, House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi on SCOTUS. We cannot perpetuate a broken immigration system that tears apart families. She's our congressional correspondent and on Twitter at Cindy Singh. So you can tell there's definitely a big difference between the two parties on this issue. Jim?
Well, thanks as always for checking out the reactions online, G. And you can follow her on Twitter yourself, her handle at G. Abby Lee. And she also tweets from our International Edition account at VOA_IE. And you can follow me out there as well at VOA Stevenson. Well, immigration has become such a big issue in this U.S. presidential election cycle that it has brought up some memories of the Japanese-American internment camps during World War II. At the time, thousands of immigrants from Japan were rounded up and detained amid fear that they would somehow be involved with the hostile actions of their former homeland. Joining us via Skype is Hank Umamoto. He wrote a book about his time in a camp called Mazanar in California. Hank, what was your experience in the early 1940s?
Well, before it wasn't bad. I was born and raised in Florian, that's a suburb, I mean, not suburb, but rural area near Sacramento. And we were grape and strawberry farmers. And there we were predominantly Japanese. So there was no, we didn't feel any discrimination or anything of that sort. We had white neighbors, so we got along very well. Then came Pearl Harbor, and we had to leave.
How were people in your community sent to the internment camps?
They divided the West Coast, the evacuation area, the Washington, Oregon, and California, into 108 areas, and they called it exclusion areas. And first one to evacuate were the Bainbridge people. There were about 350 of them, and they were sent to Mazanar internment camp. And by the time it came to our turn, ours was 92, and we evacuated. We were told to evacuate our area by midnight May 30th, 1942. So there was this 5 or 6 month period. It took that long to evacuate everybody. During the meantime, in February, a couple months after Pearl Harbor, they started building the internment camps, 10 main relocation camps. Mazanar was one of the camps. While they were building, they were evacuating the people faster than they were building the camp. So what are they going to do with these people? So what they did was they used the fairgrounds and the racetracks as temporary shelter until the permanent camps were ready.
Do you know how many Japanese Americans were sent to these camps, and did they have any other choices?
There were 113,000 people who were sent to camps. I mean, we had a choice of leaving the area. 5,000 people voluntarily left the West Coast, but the rest of us, 113,000, we didn't have anywhere to go. So we were sent to camps. There were eight towers, searchlights, machine guns, and barbed wire fence, armed soldiers patrolling the area. Yeah, at first, it was sort of like a concentration camp. But then the people turned it into a community. So we had activities, and opportunities.
As Japanese Americans like yourself made the best of living in the camps, what else did you have that turned out to be good?
I was born on a farm with outhouses. At camp, there was this high technology gadget, like flushing toilet. And they had luxury items like toilet tissue. So by the time I left Mazanar, my aggression, my frustration, my anger, it had disappeared. And today, you could tell that I have nothing but fond memories of Mazanar.
Hank Umamoto is the author of Mazanar to Mount Whitney. Hank, thank you so much for joining us and giving us this great eyewitness account of living in the Japanese-American internment camps.
Well, it was fun talking with you.
Well, Hank Umamoto could see Mount Whitney in California from his camp, and he longed to climb it one day. He finally did that at age 71. He's now in his late 80s and is a volunteer guide for the U.S. National Park Service at the now-preserved Mazanar Camp. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. The United Nations on Monday indicated it could not issue invitations to Syrian peace talks scheduled to take place next week because until there's a consensus among members of the International Syria Support Group on which opposition representatives can engage on the country's future with the government. Farhan Haq is a spokesman for UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
At this stage, the UN will proceed with issuing invitations when the countries spearheading the International Syria Support Group process come to an understanding on who among the opposition should be invited. The Secretary General urges those countries to redouble efforts to reach that agreement. Right now, the objective is and remains to get the parties to talks in Geneva by the date of the 25th of January. At the same time, of course, there are concerns about the arrangements. He is, as we speak, in touch with the members of the Security Council. And so we will have to see whether the various parties, the members of the Security Council, whether we can all come to an agreement on the best way forward. If we need to alter our timetable one way or another, we'll let you know. But right now, our target remains as it was.
17 world powers plan to be at the Geneva talks, including the United States, Russia, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, who hold different views on the country's future, including the fate of President Bashar al-Assad. The talks are aimed at setting up a transitional government. In an interview Monday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said the Geneva conference is the only way to get a political settlement. Syria analyst David Leish of Trinity College in Texas told VOA's Victor Beatty deciding on who will represent the opposition in Geneva was always, in his mind, one of the biggest challenges to ending the five-year civil war that has killed at least 250,000 people and displaced millions.
There's just too many disparate groups backed by different regional international players that have different agendas, and this has been one of the Achilles heels of the Syrian opposition since the beginning of the uprising. There's many different fault lines. You have differences from the beginning that have been papered over somewhat between political opposition, most of them outside of Syria, and the armed opposition inside of Syria, armed opposition, non-ISIS or non-Jabhat al-Nusra, which all sides are excluding from the talks. And then, of course, you have Russia and Iran pushing for some groups, particularly Russia, who pushing for some opposition groups that many in other elements of the Syrian opposition, backed by the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks, among others, accused of being collaborators with the regime, because from the beginning they've called for dialogue and a political resolution rather than the armed opposition. So there's many different fault lines. Of course, the breach in relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran haven't helped matters at all. And then, of course, you have the death of Zahran Alush, who is the head of one of the leading armed opposition groups, the Jaish al-Islam, the Army of Islam, back in December. And he was one of the few leading armed opposition elements, leading figures who attended the conference in Saudi Arabia and was willing to play a role in the makeup of the Syrian opposition council that would meet theoretically with the Syrian government representatives in Geneva on January 25th. So these are, many, many obstacles to overcome. I'd be very, very surprised if that January 25th meeting is held. They're already talking about delays.
Is this issue insurmountable in your view?
It's not insurmountable. It's just finding the right moment. Sometimes the right moment will take the realization of a stalemate on the battlefront, which has occurred from time to time, but recently we've had some fluctuations with the Russian intervention. The Syrian government forces have made some gains. They've also experienced some losses recently or setbacks against the Islamic State. And also trying to find a point when the regional players on opposing sides, the international players on opposing sides are all on the same page. And that's very, very hard to do. The main objective right now is just to keep the Vienna process going, if in name only, just so there's not the appearance of a diplomatic setback.
UN diplomats meeting with Syrian envoy Staffan de Mistura on Monday in a closed-door session said he told them that additional work needs to be done, but no new date for the Geneva talks was considered. It's been 2 months now since the Paris terrorist attacks, and some people in France are concerned that they may only be a preview for a deadlier terror strike to come. In the French capital, local firefighters have been conducting workshops on life-saving first aid techniques that people could use in case that happens. Lisa Bryant attended one of the first sessions and has this report for VOA.
A shootout outside a cafe, chairs overturned, people lying on the ground, some bleeding heavily. A woman calls for emergency services. She has basic first aid training. She's told what to do until help arrives. Stop the flow of blood, move people into positions so they can breathe, move quickly to treat the most serious cases. Such a scenario, facing about a dozen Parisians one recent afternoon, was not real. The group was taking a two-hour class in first aid techniques at a fire station in the city's northern Montmartre neighborhood.
Sur une caserne, il y a deux sessions de formation dans l'après-midi.
Fire station commander Fabien Testa organized the weekly workshops in half a dozen fire stations around the French capital. The course will soon be extended to outlying suburbs. By June, firefighters hope to train about 8,000 area residents in basic life-saving techniques. Last year's terrorist attacks in Paris have lent urgency to their mission. The November 13th assault killed and injured nearly 500 people.
Cette question, elle vient pas a posteriori, c'est des questions qui ont été demandées directement par les Parisiens.
Testa says when firefighters performed first aid at the attack sites, Parisians asked how they could help. The course was designed to show how simple gestures save lives. The course teaches techniques like how to apply a tourniquet or reposition a wounded person so his or her airway stays open and that person can breathe. People practice giving CPR or a cardiac massage on mannequins. The lesson, in a crisis, every minute counts. It's a lesson that's also being taught to civilians elsewhere, amid worldwide fears of more terrorist attacks. Gosha Katula took the training. She spent time in Paris as well as in Brussels, another city affected by last year's attacks.
Now I think many people start to have like a second reflection of what has happened. The reflection, how would I react? What would I do if I see something? We just realized that we really know nothing.
Another Parisian, Loic Kempf, had wanted to take first aid training for some time.
We learned to evaluate first if someone is unconscious or well. And then we tried the heart massage and defibrillator, and then we learn to stop the bleeding.
That knowledge won't stop a future attack, but it will give Kempf the tools to save lives should one occur. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment.
Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, you know, sometimes in life, we like to have all the stars aligning, meaning good things are happening. Well, here's something free that you can see. It's not the stars aligning, but starting Wednesday and lasting for about a month, five planets, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, will all be visible in the morning sky. All you have to do is get out of bed and go look. Moreover, the planets are expected to be quite bright and lined up diagonally, with Mercury being on the left. The planets can be distinguished from stars because they tend to shine more steadily without the twinkling associated with starlight. According to EarthSky.org, this will be the first time since early 2015 to view this planetary alignment. Well, we lost a big star in the world of music, musician and songwriter Glenn Frey, a founding member of the Eagles, of one of the most popular rock groups in the United States, has died at the age of 67. A statement released by the band said that Frey died on Monday in New York from complications of illnesses they say he had been battling for weeks. Frey, along with Don Henley, formed the Eagles in the early 1970s. The group's greatest hits album, along with the album Hotel California, are among the top-selling recordings of all time. The Eagles split up in 1980. Frey achieved some success with a solo career, as did some of the others. The group reunited in 1994 and were one of the world's most popular concert acts. The Eagles were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, as they should have been, in 1998. Our Hall of Famers, Susan Yockey, and Border Crossings host Larry London reminisced about Glenn Frey.
The music industry suffers yet another loss. It's been a very difficult start to 2016. Of course, Natalie Cole passed away. Recently, it was David Bowie. And now you can add to the list Glenn Frey, who did, in fact, start the Eagles. And at the time, he and Don Henley were backup singers for Linda Ronstadt. That's where they started together back in the 60s. And now here we are 45 years after the Eagles first began, and we've lost another music pioneer.
And he is really credited with starting what they called country rock. Maybe you could describe that for us.
Well, it's a combination of folk and rock. So a lot of artists these days do crossover music and make the crossover successfully, Taylor Swift most notably. But Glenn Frey was doing it long, long before Taylor Swift was even born. And so people like good music. And in the United States, in radio, we like to give music a label. But good music is good music, whether it's country or rock or country rock. Good music is good music. Glenn Frey, along with Don Henley and without Don Henley, wrote so many great songs. In fact, Glenn Frey wrote Hotel California, which we all know to be sung by Don Henley. But Glenn wrote that song along with many, many other Eagles hits.
Like, for instance,
Tequila Sunrise, The Heat Is On, which was his own solo hit, Take It Easy, Peaceful, Easy Feeling. These are all songs that Glenn Frey wrote along with Don Henley.
'Cause I got a peaceful, easy feeling, and I know you won't let me down, 'cause I'm already standing on the ground.
And that was the drummer in his band, and they met by coincidence at one point, and they just hit it off, and they took off.
That's right, and Don Henley issued a statement today that he's lost a brother. And despite all the difficulties that the Eagles faced, and they did have their share of challenges over the years, they were always brothers and remain brothers, and he's got a gaping void in his life now, left by somebody that he loved dearly.
The band split up for a while, and then they came back together, mm-hmm. and then they kept going strong again. What was it, 14 years they were apart?
That's right. They took a 14-year break, a much-needed break, and they went in different solo directions for a while. They reunited and remained on tour until just this last July. And in fact, from what I understand, the Eagles were supposed to be inducted into the Kennedy Center Honors. They decided to postpone that because Glenn Frey was undergoing surgery for his colitis that he was suffering from. And so, unfortunately, they you know, he didn't live to see that honor.
Well, you're probably too young, Larry, but I'm not.
Probably.
I remember when this was a big band. Some people say it was the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and the Eagles. Do you remember them at all in elementary school? I guess that's when you...
Come on now, Susan. I appreciate the kind words, but yes, I recall being on the radio in Detroit back in the 70s. I started in radio in 75, and I was on the air in Detroit in 79, right when the Eagles were at their height of popularity. And I remember them releasing The Long Run and some of the other popular music that they put out back there in the late 70s and throughout the 80s as well. And, you know, it's a page from the songbook of my life.
Yes.
And I'm sure it is from yours as
well.
Yes, it
is.
It's always sad when the music business loses another pioneer.
Well, thank you, Larry, for stopping by.
Thank you, Susan.
Don't let the sound of your own wheels make you crazy. Come on, babe, don't say babe. I gotta know if your sweet love is gonna save me.
You know, legend has it that Don Henley and Glenn Frey first talked about being the Eagles when they were doing a tour gig right here in Washington, in Georgetown to be specific. Yeah. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. We're also out there on Twitter. Follow us at @VOA_IE. Our band that's still together is director Tracy Carter and engineer Chaz Hall. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're also in Washington. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
New technological advances in the demining process is saving lives. One organization on the forefront of such innovation is the Golden West Humanitarian Foundation, which recently won the 2016 CES Innovation Award with its Advanced Ordnance Training Material Project. This project uses advanced three-dimensional printing technology to create models of landmines and military ordnance to train demining technicians in post-conflict countries worldwide. With support from the Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement in the State Department's Bureau of Political Military Affairs, Golden West Humanitarian Foundation has worked to make the environment safer in heavily mine-impacted countries since 1998. From recycling unexploded ordnance in Cambodia to teaching children about the risks of unexploded ordnance, Golden West takes a comprehensive approach to safeguarding the lives and livelihoods of people living in areas contaminated with explosive remnants of war. The United States is the world's largest single financial supporter of efforts to clear unexploded ordnance and landmines. The United States has contributed more than $2.5 billion since 1993 to over 90 countries around the world through more than 60 partner organizations like Golden West Humanitarian Foundation to reduce the harmful effects of illicitly proliferated and indiscriminately used conventional weapons of war. Just 15 years ago, landmines and other explosive remnants of war killed or injured nearly 10,000 men, women, and children every year, more than 25 every day. Thanks to the concerted efforts of the United States, partner nations, international non-governmental organizations, and new technology provided by organizations like Golden West Humanitarian Foundation, that figure, which has now dropped by more than 60%, will continue to go down.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.